An application to college?
Uh-huh.
But you're going to study in New York. Denver, it's 1,500 miles away.
1,628 to be exact.
Well, that's quite a distance.
I don't think I'll be missed.
Oh, don't be unfair, Susie. You know I'd miss you.
I'm sure you'd be too busy to miss anyone. Much too busy.
Well, you give me credit for nothing. Yes, I'm ambitious. Perhaps too ambitious. But it's been for your sake as well as mine. Isn't this house just a little bit nicer than a cold water flat? And your new horse? Aren't you just crazy
yes,
about
but
it?
I...
And that closet of yours?
Has all the dresses fit for the daughter of a famous star.
Now, just a moment, young lady. It's only because of my ambition that you've had the best of everything. And that's a solid achievement that any mother can be proud of.
And how about a mother's love?
Love? But you've always had that.
Yes, by telephone, by postcard, by magazine interviews. You've given me everything but yourself. No wonder I went to Annie last night when I told her about Steve.
Oh, Susie. If Steve is going to come between us, I'll give him up. I'll never see him again.
Oh, Mama, stop acting. Stop trying to shift people around as if they were pawns on a stage.
But Susie,
don't worry, I'll get over Steve. But please, don't play the martyr.
Welcome once again to the Plastic Podcast. I'm Robert Davis. Today, J. Robert Parks and I are talking about the 1959 film Imitation of Life, directed by Douglas Sirk. It's a great American movie, and we're going to get into the thick of it here in a few minutes. First, a couple of notes. They're making a new Star Wars movie. It's a different guy doing it, though. It's different people. It's not George Lucas. He's passed it off to someone else. And they're making three of them. One of them is basically done and coming out this year, I think. The next one, though, is being written and directed by Rian Johnson, who I was recently reminded talked with us on this podcast, but it was a long time ago. It was before he was directing Star Wars. It was before he directed those two episodes of Breaking Bad, one of which was basically the culmination of the series. It was before he made Looper. It was actually, he had released one film and made a second, but hadn't released it yet. And so we were talking about that, the Brothers Bloom, starring Mark Ruffalo and Adrian Brody and Rachel Weisz. And it was a good conversation, and someone recently reminded me of it because one of the things we talked about briefly was what it's like to work with a suddenly much larger budget. And I think people who like Star Wars will be glad to hear what he had to say about that, if it's still true. So look for that at plasticpodcast.com. It's an oldie. Look for Rian Johnson and the Brothers Bloom. It's there. It's in the list. Here's J. Robert Parks.
Hi, Rob.
Hey, J. Robert.
So today we're going to talk about an old film, well, kind of old, from 1959, a Douglas Sirk film called Imitation of Life. And I remember this was actually probably one of the first classic Hollywood movies I saw when I first started watching movies back in the mid-90s. So it's about almost 20 years now. And it was certainly my first Sirk film. And when we had been, I forget how this came up, but we were talking about Imitation of Life in an earlier podcast. And I was like, oh, we should revisit that. Or I should watch that again because I hadn't seen it since. And so I got the DVD. And it's interesting, and I'm sure we'll talk about this as we go, but it was interesting how my perception of the movie changed more, I think, because of what I remembered differently. But the movie is about two women. A aspiring actress played by Lana Turner and a African-American woman who, as we see at the beginning of the movie, really has no job and kind of no place to go, but she's very organized and she kind of finds a way to become part of Laura, who's Lana Turner's character, Laura's life. And the key thing is that they both each have a daughter. The African-American woman who's played by Juanita Moore, Annie Johnson is the character's name. Her daughter, Sarah Jane, is slightly older than Lana Turner's daughter. But these four women, so the two mothers and the two daughters, form a kind of household. Lana Turner's character, as we learn early on, is a widow. And we don't know Annie Johnson what her sort of marital status is. Well, I guess we do. We learn later that her husband also had died. But these in the first third of the movie, they are struggling. Lana Turner's come to New York trying to get work as an actress. trying to make a go of that and is struggling with that. But then she gets a big break about, I think, a third the way through the film. And then the rest of the movie is about how this relationship changes and between the two women, and also what changes with their daughters, because the movie about halfway through then skips ahead several years. So the daughters are no longer like 5 and 6, but are now in their teen years, late teen years. And so the movie is from 1959, it's a movie about race. It's a movie about class and how wealth changes things. It's about the difficulties of parenthood, I guess, in a way. And this seems very cliche now the way I'm describing this, but it's a rich film. It's a really great movie, I think, anchored by both Lana Turner and Juanita Moore, I think, are fantastic. And that sense of you know, what it's like, it's a woman's picture in the best sense of the word. And revisiting it was great fun. What do you think?
I think it's a great movie, but I think it's great for lots of interesting reasons. Mm. I think it's a bundle of contradictions, really. I think it's a melodrama that you could see as a little sappy in mm-hmm. some ways, but Douglas Sirk is the guy who directed it with far more thought than you'd think would go into a movie like this. Mm. And it's his hallmark, actually. It is. He's become known for this. He wasn't at the time, I think. He was a successful director of these kinds of women's melodramas. They're women's pictures, I guess they call them. But these melodramas that were sort of built around women's issues and mostly, I guess, marketed to women. But as people have gone back and looked at them, they've seen all these things that were in them that maybe weren't noticed at the time. And he's like the textbook example of the auteur theory, which I think we actually should spend a few minutes talking about it. It's you know, this phrase comes up a lot, and it sounds sort of like it's sort of hackneyed. Maybe we should. You almost don't want to dive into it because it's been so discussed. But I feel like people sort of get it wrong sometimes. Mm-hmm. The idea was there were these guys in France. This is where all this pivotal stuff originated, it feels like. But there were these young people in France who just hung out at the Cinémathèque Française, which was this place run by Henri Langlois. He had funding to actually archive movies, so he was just storing up films, and he showed them all the time. They had this house with two levels. I've heard they showed a movie on the first level and a movie on the second level, and sometimes they had a third movie showing on the stairs in between. And these young people would just hang out there and just lie on the floor in front of this screen, this sheet on the wall, and just watch movies. And this was an invaluable education in film because there was no way, unlike now, there was no way to just dial up whatever movie you want to see. And so they were just living, breathing movies for a long time. And this group of people went on to start this magazine called Cahiers de Cinéma, Cinema Notes, which has become very influential because of just the ideas and things that were written there. And then most of them actually went on to make movies as well. Mm-hmm. We're talking about François Truffaut and Jean-Luc Godard and Agnès Varda and Jacques Rivette and Eric Rohmer and Claude Chabrol. And these, you know, some of them are household names, or not, if not household names, they're known by the people who make the movies that you've heard of. they became very influential to American filmmakers, in part because some of their ideas were... they were appreciating a lot of American films that were seen as fluff, I think, at the time. Mm. They had idiosyncratic ideas about Alfred Hitchcock, who was seen as successful but not a serious artist until they began to really think about him in that way. And Douglas Sirk is another. And part of their idea was this auteur theory, they called it. Auteur being the French word for author, but that there are these people who maybe... they work for a studio. This is how it worked back then. The director was employed by the studio. He's like a middle manager. He gets hired. He's handed a script and says, "Here, make this movie." Mm. And he, you know, hires the people to do it and puts it together and he pulls the project together and he's a success at that. And then they give him another project. Mm. But it wasn't like, you know, the people who worked in the system, it wasn't like they had choice of whatever, you know, that they were, you know, expressing some story they've always wanted to tell or whatever like that. Right. Douglas Sirk didn't set out to make this movie about these two women. And it just sort of, it was handed to him and said, "Here, make this." But what they found probably by, you know, watching many of these movies over and over was that you start to see common traits in Douglas Sirk's films, for example. Yeah. It's almost like he's communicating in some cinematic language that isn't necessarily in the words that are coming out of the characters' mouths or in the plot. It's in the way things are framed. It's in the way it's in where he puts the camera. It's in where he places his cuts. It's in what he chooses to emphasize when. And it's unmistakable. And I think we tend to see movies that way now, but at the time this was novel.
Right.
And so, you know, certain filmmakers, their star has risen since then because of this sort of reevaluation. And I think we owe it to Godard and Truffaut and these folks who sort of set this in motion. And this movie is my one of my favorite examples of that because it's it is really melodramatic, but it's really affecting. Mm-hmm. For one thing, I feel like Cirque took that seriously. He didn't undercut any of that. In fact, he amped it up. You know, you could say. I mean, it's a tearjerker, certainly. But also, it really withstands scrutiny. And I hope we'll talk about some specific scenes here and give examples of what I mean by that. But it's a complex movie for a lot of reasons.
It is. It is. And it's interesting. Talking about auteur theory, I had a surprising experience for me. I didn't remember when I was watching it again when it was made. And so I didn't think about how it fits into Cirque's career. And so when I went back to sort of do a little bit of research, I was genuinely surprised to see that it's his last feature.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't feel that way to me. It feels like, you know, the sort of the earlier melodramas of the, particularly of the early 50s, this movie's from 59. Imitation of Life feels a little bit more almost reserved in comparison to those, particularly in the visual style. It's not quite as widescreen or as emphasizing the widescreen format. It's not quite as emphasizing the color that you could do with Technicolor at the time. And so it feels, even though like you say, it's a melodrama and it's very affecting, it didn't feel quite as ostentatious as some of the earlier Cirques. And I found that interesting to then think about, oh, it's interesting that his last feature would be a bit dialing back on the style. And it feels a little bit more almost classic Hollywood in its emphasis on, subtlety is not the right word, but you know what I mean. The sense that we don't have to, it's not just an exhibition of style. Not to say that Cirque's earlier movies were, because they had, you know, there's a lot of depth to them. But it wasn't quite as obvious on the surface, I guess, what was going on.
Yeah, I think he reserves it for a few key moments when it's like very dense all of a sudden with those ideas that are suddenly come to the fore, or at least, you know, to our eyes nowadays.
Like, what's a scene that stands out for you in that way?
Well, I think we have to talk about sort of one of the central issues of the movie is that Sarah Jane, who's Annie's daughter, has light enough skin that she can pass for white and actually wants to.
Yeah.
She says in anger at one point, my mother can't change her color, but I can and I will.
Mm-hmm.
And it's troubling the way Annie from the beginning, lowers herself in order to obtain a certain position for her daughter.
Yeah.
If you don't always know what her rationalization is, but we assume that it's to give her daughter a home, and you know, they're homeless at the very beginning.
Yep.
But they managed to join forces with Laura and her daughter and basically become her housekeeper and ingratiate themselves to her, basically. And she's constantly lowering herself and placing herself in what I think we now consider, you know, a really uncomfortable position, you know, of servitude, basically. Yep. And her daughter can't bear this, can't stand it.
Yep.
And her mother doesn't want her to be embarrassed by her color,
sure.
And yet she's not giving her an example that she can embrace, you know, they're from different eras. They're from different mindsets. And so this is really troubling to Sarah Jane. And she begins to sneak out at night and she sees, a boy who's white and she has this sort of secret life. And I think that this is the key scene of the movie. It is a pivotal point in the movie. It's around the center of the movie. She goes on a date. She is standing in an alley waiting, for him to come.
Yeah.
He arrives. She tells him what they could do. They could go to such and such. And he says, okay, that sounds good. But first, let me ask you, is it true? And she says, what? And he says, is your mother? And he uses the worst racial epithet you can imagine for the situation. And she denies it.
Mm-hmm.
And he slaps her. He actually hits her repeatedly, beats her to the ground. And she's lying in a puddle and he walks away down the alley. And then we cut back to Laura's house. And this is just, there are so many things we can say about this. I want to talk about it in detail in several ways. But the first thing is simply on a visceral level, how this feels. Because the first time I saw this movie was at the Castro Theater in San Francisco, which is a great old movie palace with a Wurlitzer organ, similar to the Music Box in Chicago, but it has something like 1,400 seats. It's really huge. And it has a great schedule, and for a long time it was programmed by this woman named Anita Manga, who just had a really keen sense of the neighborhood and of what people wanted to see. They would show art films and retrospectives, and they would show, you know, they could show the, they actually participated in the Ozu retrospective with the Pacific Film Archive, but then they'd also show Scorsese, and they'd show a lot of melodramas and things like that. But it also, and I love the theater, but it attracts a certain audience for certain types of films, especially melodramas of the 50s. This is ground zero for that kind of thing, which is an audience that wants to come and laugh at the movie. You know, Mystery Science Theater 3000 style. Let's laugh at how backward the whole, how much they're overacting and things like that. And I understand the fun of that, but when it's a serious movie, I feel really I feel really mad when I'm sitting in an audience like that. Yeah. But in this case, you just have to wait. Just wait, because they may be laughing at Imitation of Life. They were when I was watching it. There was a sizable crowd there that were laughing. But when you reach this point, everything changes. And it really feels like Cirque has thrown ice water on that crowd. There's silence, and it feels like shock, because I think it's for several reasons. First, it's audacious. This is the language suddenly, and the fact that it's a physical beatdown.
Yeah, it is.
In the middle of this glossy color movie.
Yes. Yeah.
And it feels like the rules have shifted from what I thought they were, or I'm not sure how to process this. Is this exploitative? Is this is the movie?
It's uncomfortable.
Suddenly, it doesn't compute. Yes, yeah. It is uncomfortable. Yeah.
I think in part because it does feel like you're not, you haven't been thrown for a loop, but the stakes are raised and you realize what's at stake in ways that you hadn't quite before. Talking about sort of watching it again, I remember the first time I watched it, I found Sarah Jane's character to be a little bit irritating. She seemed a little spoiled. I had such a strong connection with Annie Johnson's character that I found the disrespect that her daughter has off-putting. This time, watching it again, I was much more sympathetic to Sarah Jane's character, much more sympathetic at this really horrible position that she's in of wanting to somehow pass and trying desperately. And by the way, knowing that if she can, her life will be better. You know, there's this amazing line that her mom says to Lana Turner's character early in the film. You know, how do you explain to your child she was born to be hurt? And there's truth in that. I mean, that's a true statement in the 50s. And so Sarah Jane's desperate attempt to somehow escape, the legacy of her race at that time, it felt much more compelling to me. Much more powerful this time, and I had much more sympathy for how she treats her mother badly as the movie goes on. But I think that scene that you mentioned, it becomes the pivotal scene in that, you know, in that sense that we sort of really understand, or at least as best we can. I mean, it's, you know, it's always dangerous as a white person to say I understand, but to understand what at least what Cirque is trying to communicate about this.
Yeah, and to look at, this is also a great scene to look at his the way it's directed, because it's really strange. Yeah. So it begins with the boyfriend arriving, and they have this conversation. And the second that he questions her about her mother, the soundtrack is filled with this really up-tempo jazz.
Yeah, which by the way, is out of place. I mean, it feels out of place.
Yes, it certainly does. Also, the camera swivels to look away.
Yeah.
And my first reaction was, it's looking away from something that's uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of like in Taxi Driver, Scorsese, there's a scene where we're watching Travis Bickle on the phone begging this woman for a second date, if I remember right.
Oh, that's right.
Whatever, I think that's it. But does the phone call is very embarrassing. And the camera just pans away and looks down an empty hallway while we continue to hear a little more of the conversation. Yeah. It's as if this is too painful to watch.
Yeah.
And at first I thought that's what Cirque was doing too. Just look away for a second. But that's not the end. And what he swivels to is a plate glass window. It's a storefront. Mm. And you can see the action framed perfectly in that window.
Mm-hmm.
And it suddenly feels like we're watching a movie. It suddenly feels like this is movies. Here you've got the screen, you've got the exciting music, you've got We're going to see some action. It feels like a weird critique almost, or a commentary on the movie that he himself is making, or this style of film that he's making. And then if he doesn't end there, he cuts back and we watch the slaps in quite close, and we end with the camera down on the ground at her level.
No, and in a tight close-up.
Yeah, down next to the puddle, and her boyfriend is off in the distance, sort of silhouetted almost like the cover of a James M. Cain novel or something.
Like, she's like, you know, just in a puddle of mud.
Yeah. Then we cut to Laura's house. And this is no coincidence. Annie is giving Laura a foot rub. Is giving Miss Laura, she calls her, a foot rub, and Laura says, "Ah, that felt so good." And that, in contrast with what we just saw, is audacious. I mean, it's also important to note that he cuts directly to that. He's known for these dissolves, and anytime in his movies that he's changing time, he's changing location, he always does this very luxurious dissolve. It's part of what gives his movies this sort of pillowy, fluffy quality. But not in this case. He cuts directly to that, and there's this very interesting piece of dialogue that really draws this parallel, strangely, between Laura and this boyfriend. I mean, it's a masterful cut.
Yeah, that's
and
nice.
It says more than any anything else in the film, I think.
Yeah, no, that's nice. I like that. I hadn't thought about that, but that's right. It's interesting too, talking about sort of editing. The movie opens on some beach, Coney Island maybe. And there's just thousands of people on this sunny summer day. And then we see Laura's character, and she's sort of very frantically looking for something, and we can guess pretty quickly that she's looking for her child, even though we haven't seen the child yet. And this scene then, as she sort of struggles to find her child, then we realize that her child is actually with Annie Johnson's character, and because Susie has been playing with Sarah Jane, and Susie doesn't realize that she's lost, but her mom thinks that she's lost. But what's fascinating about that scene is how it plays with audiences' expectations, because we know very quickly that a child has been lost, but we don't quite realize who is related to who when we actually meet them. And what's very quickly apparent is that each person, at least each adult, is dissembling in some way. You know, they're imitating in some way. And it's sort of the way that Cirque edits this piece puts that together, I think, because it's like, oh, we assume that these two ladies know each other. Well, they don't. We assume that, and actually other people assume too, that both daughters belong to Laura because they both look white. And then someone else assumes that Laura is actually married to this other gentleman that she's just met. But they're not. They just met. They have no relationship, at least initially. And so there's all these expectations or assumptions that people make.
Laura assumes that Annie is just watching Sarah Jane, who belongs to someone else, because they don't seem to have the
same
color.
That's right. And so there's this sense of which we are making similar assumptions, and Cirque, and some of those assumptions, by the way, the characters want people to make. That's part of how they are imitating life, so to speak. But it sets those themes right away and really beautifully. And it does this, I think, with really crisp editing, because at every point we start to make assumptions, we, within about 10 seconds, realize, oh, wait, that assumption isn't true. And it sort of then prepares you then for the rest of the film, which is also about people acting or people imitating or people trying to get other people to assume certain things. And so it's a great opening scene. It's one of my favorites.
Yeah. Laura asks, how long have you been looking after Sarah Jane? And she says, oh, all her life. You know, she could have explained right then, but she doesn't. She has that kind of pithy remark. And it reminds me that Annie, I know that Laura is the professional actor, but Annie is acting from beginning to end. It is her entire life, I feel, that she's chosen this role, and her rationalization is her daughter, and that she's going to be repaid in the next life, but she's going to play this role, and it's almost seamless. There are times when, there's a crack, like when Laura says, oh, it never occurred to me that you have friends. I have lots of friends. Yeah. Well, you never asked, she says, with a big smile on her face, you know. And her daughter can't do that. Yeah. There's a time when when Laura asks her to she's going to take a tray of food out to Laura, who's visiting with someone. Right. And she puts on this very exaggerated accent and acts like a servant from the 30s. Mm-hmm. And it's really embarrassing to Laura. And Laura comes in and chews her out for it. And she says, "If I ever treated you any differently." And the fact is, she has. We've seen it. Sarah Jane lives in this middle ground where she lives in this house, but she's not welcome at these parties that they throw. Right. She's not an employer either.
Yeah.
Your mother doesn't own me, she says to Susie at one point.
Mm. It's one of the things that's interesting about the four women is that Laura has to pretend as well to get ahead. Part of it's just being an actress, but she has to pretend in lots of other ways. So, you know, when she meets someone, she has to pretend. When she has to pretend that she's actually, you know, has more experience than she does. And she's good at that, and that's how she gets ahead. But yet, that's compared to most of the time, Laura cannot pretend. She can act as if, you know, she's just who she is. But you get the sense that Annie has to pretend every moment of her life. She has to pretend to be what people expect her to, particularly what white people expect her to be. And I think the movie has a really powerful commentary in the sense of just, and I hesitate to generalize, but it really does feel like this, of what it's like to be black in middle 20th century and trying to pass, so to speak, in white culture. And even if you're not trying to pass as white, you're trying to pass. You have to act a certain way. You have to fulfill the assumptions that white people have of who you are and who and what you'll be. And for Annie, she has internalized that so perfectly that she's the master of it, and doesn't quite maybe even realize how she has done that. But like you say, Sarah Jane, her daughter, can't do that, hasn't learned how to do that, or refuses to learn how to do that in that way. She's going to try to do it in a different way, which, of course, then becomes her undoing. And I think the movie is genuinely powerful on that point.
Yeah, I feel like this story could have been made, basically the same plot, in a much simpler way, mm-hmm. that would have just sort of underscored what a burden it is to be an African American in America. And that's still an element of the story. But I feel like Cirque highlights the privilege mm-hmm. of Laura and her daughter, and over again, that this isn't a level playing field. This isn't the American dream we're witnessing here. This is a stacked deck.
Yeah.
I mean, her friend Steve, he's a vice president of something, but he's going to quit just to see the world and follow the wind. And this is in contrast to, you know, how we see Annie working every day of her life, you know, and there are lots of details like that Cirque purposely highlights. Mm-hmm. There's a moment when Laura's trying to think about what her next role should be, and she's considering this one, and she has someone there advising her, and they're telling her, don't take this one. It has this colored angle that's so controversial. Mm. And Cirque makes sure that Annie's in the back of this scene. Yeah. And as they're talking, the guy who's trying to talk her out of it, doing this controversy, he picks up a drink that Annie has just made for him, and he drinks it. I mean, it's this, you know, this drink appeared out of the ether for him. It was actually made by Annie. We saw her make it in the background and set it down on the counter. I mean, that's the sort of thing that we talk about when we're talking about Cirque, that the things that are going on the edges and in the back are as important as the surface text of the movie.
But yet, and also, and to go along with that, the thing that's impressive about the film is that we don't have standard villains in this movie, right? I mean, it's Laura's character is not a bad person. I mean, she's oblivious in some ways, and yet she genuinely likes Annie. She genuinely likes Sarah Jane, but she doesn't realize what she's doing. And I think in that sense, the movie is a pretty powerful indictment. Because it doesn't let the audience say, oh, that person's ignorant, or that person, look, I would never do that. In a lot of ways, I think, particularly people at the time, but even people today, we probably identify more with Laura's character, and may not quite even notice all the subtle ways in which, she treats Annie like a servant.
Yeah. See, it feels to me like a movie made by an outsider. Mm-hmm. I mean, maybe it's because I know about Cirque. He's a German man. He left Germany in the late 30s for the same reasons a lot of people left Germany in the 30s. And he came to America and spent 2 decades becoming a filmmaker, making films. He had already made films there, but he continued his filmmaking here and became famous for that. And it really feels to me like a movie made by someone who didn't grow up in America, where we're the country itself is a product of this, you know, this racist past.
Right.
A little bit like this is maybe this may be a crass comparison, but I thought of, you know, that Christoph Waltz character in Django Unchained, the yes. silly Tarantino yeah. movie about right. about slavery. Well, he's a German dentist, but he's not practicing dentistry anymore. He's come to America and he's a bounty hunter. That's he right. finds people who are wanted and he brings them in and collects the reward. That's what he does. He's the perfect sort of character for one of these spaghetti western type things. His personality is different from Clint Eastwood, but Clint Eastwood would find a town by accident where there were two factions warring and say, man, could make a lot of money in a town like this. Well, Christoph Waltz is, he's got his business going, but it's a bit, the whole slavery thing is a bit of a mystery to mm-hmm. him, and he joins forces with this escaped slave, and if they can find the men he's looking for mm-hmm. and bring some justice to some slave owners at the same time, that's a win-win as far mm-hmm. as he's concerned. It's a little bit funny that popped into my head, but I sort of see Cirque as this outsider who is a bit, I won't say puzzled. Racism is all over the world. Sure. But there is a certain distance in this movie, a certain perspective mm-hmm. looking down on, I feel like, this class structure that might have gone unremarked upon by the studio executives who passed this script treatment to him and yeah. said, here, remake this movie. This was successful 15 years ago.
Right.
You haven't seen it, but, you know, yeah. make it again.
No, I think that's fair. And I think that's often true, and not just in movies, but, you know, outsiders often, you know, see things that people who are in a society can't see for themselves or don't see it with the same kind of clarity.
I mean, Lana Turner was his star, and he didn't have to sort of highlight her cluelessness mm-hmm. And her, you know, naivete, I guess we could say, if mm-hmm. we want to be generous. But, you know, he did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Without turning her into a caricature either.
Right.
Or not turning her daughter. And her daughter is played by Sandra Dee, who I was surprised at how good she is.
Yeah.
Again, it would be easy to sort of have the daughter of privilege acting like a spoiled brat and not having any kind of character of her own, but she actually does. You know, there's a depth there to the character, and
sure.
You get the sense that Cirque really likes all of these characters, and yet that doesn't stop him from sort of highlighting, you know, the problems of what's going on.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I've always loved that Birth of a Nation is such a pivotal movie in film history that you can't tell the history of film without talking about Birth of a mm-hmm. Nation, because it just seems so perfect. Mm. Because I imagine a lot of the people who listen to our podcast have seen Birth of a Nation, but in case they haven't, it's one of the first epics. It's mm-hmm. It sort of encapsulated a lot of ideas that have been sort of brewing about how films should be put together and how you tell multiple stories and you cut from here to there, and the things that we just take for granted as film language were sort of being pioneered in the teens. It was the first sort of big example of that. And it's about this wonderful time in America's history when Abraham Lincoln signed the Emancipation Proclamation, and when slaves went wild and tried to rape white women and were, you know, luckily the Ku Klux Klan rode in with their white sheets and saved the white women. And you may think I'm exaggerating, but this is, in fact, the plot of Birth of a Nation.
No, it's a celebration of the KKK. At least a good part of it is.
It's shocking. It's really horrible mm-hmm. in its content. But you can't tell the story of American film without Birth of a Nation. There's no way to extract it. Like, there are so many times you can sort of elide these negative things in America's history by just saying, oh, that probably, you know, yeah, we won't tell that part of it. We will leave out the Ku Klux Klan or whatever. But in this case, here's this keystone film that you can't, not literally keystone, but this you know, important milestone in film that you have to include. And it just seems to me so perfect as, you know, for America. And this is, Imitation of Life is 50 years later, and there's been a lot of learning in the meantime about that. But it still feels to me that the most honest way, the most interesting way to talk about any of this is in this complex confusion, because this is a movie that's a collaboration with, you know, it's pieces from the studio. You've got actors coming in from this way. It's a remake of a story that existed before. And then you have Douglas Sirk, who's just sort of guiding things in these different ways. And inside all of that mess, somehow it all works, and it works in multiple ways. It works as a simple story that is deeply affecting, but it withstands this scrutiny that's just really rewarding. Yeah. And I find it one of the most interesting movies in American history.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, I've actually recommended Imitation of Life to a lot of people because we like a lot of different kinds of movies. And I think when you become sort of steeped in movies for a while, you develop sort of esoteric tastes sometimes. And, you know, cinephiles like things maybe that, you know, my mom and my family wouldn't like, for example.
Yeah.
But I feel like I sort of know what to recommend to various people.
Yes.
And Imitation of Life, strangely, can be recommended to a lot of different people, I feel like. I recommended it to, you know, family members who just want to see something good at the movies and they're very moved by it and love it. And yet I can recommend, you know, it's high on the list of favorites among our cinephile friends too. Yeah. So it's has a broad appeal, I think.
Yeah, it does. I agree. And we haven't even talked about Mahalia Jackson, who comes in at the end and brings the house down.
The end. Oh, the ending.
So we probably shouldn't give too much away, because I suspect a lot of listeners may not have seen the movie, and it's well worth checking out. But you want to stick around for the end. It's awesome.
The end is important in all things, as Ghost Dog says, and this is one of the great endings.
Yeah.
Should we not talk? Can we talk about anything?
Well, those of you who are not going to watch it, haven't watched it yet, you can pause now and come back in a moment.
Right. That's a good idea. Normally, we're not too concerned with spoilers, especially when we're talking about old movies. And I understand wanting to let people have the full impact of this, so please do. But the ending is Annie's funeral, of course, and it's bigger than you could imagine.
Well, and she's planned for this. It's for her, you know, it's her wedding and her funeral are the biggest days of her life. And she has saved all the money that she's, you know, it seems like any excess money she's saved for her funeral.
It's so morbid, Laura says, this idea. But it is something about how this is her reward. But it echoes the moment too when she's talking about all the people she wants, all the people from church she wants to come, all of her friends. And this is when Annie says, she never even occurred to her that she has friends. Mm-hmm. And this is the moment when Sirk reveals, having not shown us any of that, it's sort of that by obscuring that and then showing how many people are at her funeral. I mean, it's huge and people are lined up on the sidewalk and it's...
I think there's a bit of an indictment of the audience, right?
Because we
kind of are the same. It's like, oh, you have friends? Because we haven't seen them.
Exactly.
You know, and it's easy to sort of assume, oh, your whole life has revolved around your daughter and living with this, you know, actress and her daughter. And so we as the audience then become implicated in this ignorance. But
exactly. That's what he's trying to do. Yeah. And there are so many interesting details. Once she's in the carriage that's going to be pulled down the street, it's so extravagant, but it's so lovely at the same time. There are people lined up, you know, to show their respects, and none of these faces are familiar to us, but there's a little boy standing there in a suit and a hat, and he's standing next to what we assume are his parents, and as it starts rolling away, there's just a hand that takes his hat, puts it on his chest, and he's standing there looking at this sort of confused, somber, sort of a confused, somber look on his face, like, I'm not sure what's going on here. But that taking of the hat off of his head, placing it on his chest, is like, you know, show your respect.
Yep.
This is what we're doing. This is, we're showing respect.
Yeah. No, it's that moment is maybe my most moving moment in the film. I can't quite articulate why, but the taking off of the hat of respect is, I don't know, it seems to be the pinnacle of the film, even if I can't intellectually say why that would be. But watching it again, that's actually where I started crying the most, I think. Because it feels almost, maybe I will try to articulate this, but it feels almost like Sirk showing his respect in a way.
Yeah.
In a way, the film, because it wants to sort of, not fool the audience, that's not what it's doing, but it's guiding the audience, and it's guiding us with our own preconceptions and our own, you know, misconceived ideas. And then at the end, you know, it's like, oh, maybe there's more here than you realize. And that feels like then Sirka says, let me show you how much I respect this character. I think it feels quite powerful to me.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's great.
Have you seen anything good lately?
I have. Every March, the Gene Siskel Film Center downtown does a thing they call the European Union Film Festival, where they show at least one movie from every country in the European Union, which is now quite a number of them, and often three or four movies from some of the bigger countries. And so there's like 60 movies they show over the course of a month. It really is like a film fest. And I saw a couple of things that I liked. One is this German film that's gotten a fair amount of praise called The Strange Little Cat, which is, did you see it?
Yeah.
It's a strange film. It's about just sort of this day in this family where they are working around the house, and they're going to have some sort of kind of small dinner party in the evening before everyone goes out to, I think, a music concert of some kind. But it reminds me a little bit of a Hanukkah film, in that people are all a little bit off, and it's very rigorous, and you don't quite know what's going on. For some reason, I was in the right mood, and I thought it was fantastic. I laughed. I thought it was really clever what it's doing with animals and what it does with there's lots of interesting close-ups, as well as some long shots, and the way those work and interwork together, I think, is really great. So I loved that. Then on a much different level, I saw Lukas Moodysson's new movie called We Are the Best. And Lukas Moodysson is this great Swedish director who came to fame with his first couple movies called Show Me Love and Together, which really captured, I think, interesting things about childhood or teenage life. And then he went off in sort of more serious directions, and some people, a lot of people don't think those are quite as successful, although I tend to like them.
Lilia Forever.
Which I actually like a lot, but most people, I think, find it a little strident. We Are the Best returns to this sort of focus on kids, these 12, 13-year-old girls who are wannabe punkers in 1982 and decide that they're going to start a punk band. Almost as a way of kind of pissing off their older boys in their life who don't think they can do it. And it's delightful. There's no subtext. Like, Together was a movie about a commune. And so it really was about how the children are dealing with the adults' craziness in their life. There's not too much of that, although the adults are fun and We Are the Best. But it's more just about these girls, particularly these three girls, and their relationship and their love and for the boys in their life and their desire to make music. And it's good fun. How about you?
Well, that's actually good to hear. Moodysson had sort of dropped off of my list of must-see directors, and so I'm glad to hear he's back in form.
Yeah, it feels like he said, yeah, I'm good at this kids thing. I'll do this again. Because it does. It doesn't feel a lot different than what he did early on, but it's nice.
Well, I saw the new Wes Anderson film, Grand Budapest Hotel.
And how is it?
Lots of fun. Oh, good. Lots of fun. It's everything you'd expect from a Wes Anderson movie. It feels maybe a little more intricate and a little, I shouldn't say funnier, because I've laughed at all of his movies, I think. But it's lots of fun.
Okay. When I've heard from people who've seen the movie, I've always asked them, so where, for you, is it top tier Wes Anderson, middle tier Wes Anderson? Lower tier?
I think he's remarkably consistent. Okay. There's not a lot of distance between the top and the bottom for me. But I would put this in the top half.
Okay.
Yeah.
The Zizou film and the Darjeeling Limited sort of lower tier.
Life Aquatic and
Darjeeling. Life Aquatic, yeah. And whereas I find like Rushmore and Bottle Rocket and Moonrise Kingdom sort of top tier for me. So
I think I totally agree with that. Okay. Yeah. And this is among those favorite three, I would say. Well, yeah.
That's encouraging.
Yeah.
I look forward to seeing that. Yeah.
Well, that's going to do it for this edition of the Plastic Podcast. I have actually a couple of corrections to the conversation you just heard. I went back and watched that scene from Taxi Driver, and it was mostly the way I remembered it. Travis Bickle is on the phone, except for one detail. I said the camera pans away while he's talking. And actually, it's clearly a dolly, which I like better. You know, if it's a person, it's not someone just turning away. It's someone walking toward the exit. And as I was listing some people who wrote for Cahiers de Cinema and then went on to become filmmakers, I threw Agnès Varda in. I'm certain she was at the Cinémathèque Française, certain that she made films. I just don't think she was ever writing for Cahiers de Cinema. But this is a good excuse to say, go rent The Gleaners and I if you want to know what Agnès Varda is all about. It's a characteristically wonderful documentary where she does all the things that she's so good at. She points her camera at the world around her, comments with insight and wit about the things she sees, and connects them to her own life. It's really great. You can find it. The Gleaners and I. We'll be back. I'm not sure when or what we'll be talking about, but this is a long-range project, and I'm sure we have more to say. Bye.
Like then Serkka says, let me show you how much I respect this character. And I think it feels quite powerful to me.
Yeah.
So, it's great. Well, I didn't know we were ending, but that's okay. I don't have anything else to say, I think. Is there anything you wanted to add?
Yeah, let's see. I wasn't sure where that was a nice sort of end there, so I wasn't sure what to add.
Okay.